So I'd again like to start by thanking the organizers for inviting me to this very pleasant and interesting meeting. So the title that I gave was broad enough so that I can cover a couple of things. And in fact, I'm going to talk about two things that don't really have too much in common except that they are related to transverse fluctuations. And I guess basically what we've learned so far is that the problem is complicated, and unless you talk about very simple things, you can't make precise statements. So I'll start by talking about a model that is really so idealized that it probably isn't relevant to much, but for which one can make rather precise statements. And that was done with Yakov Cantor, where we looked at the fluctuations of a charged polymer in which the bond angles were only allowed to take discrete values. So basically, we ignored the possibility of continuous bends of the rod, but only allowed the bond angles to have discrete values. We are sort of trained to thinking that there shouldn't be too much difference between something that goes on at microscopic level and maybe at large enough scales we can form a continuum picture. It turns out that when you have charged systems, maybe you have to be careful, and in this model, you will not recover continuum behavior except at infinite temperature. Again, because the model has no counter ions, no screening, it is probably not very relevant. And then the question comes as to how to include the effects of counter ions. And a number of people here have talked about going beyond this equation that was developed by Boltzmann and Poisson's grandson. And so I will sort of go and talk about how to go slightly beyond that and include some fluctuations. And this was work done with Ramin Golestanian. And finally, I will use this addition of fluctuations, which is very similar to what Andrea Liu talked about in the first day of the meeting, to talk about the fluctuations of a polymer where now counter ions are included, but we are thinking about continuous deformations, and calculate the energy cost of bending, and to see whether there are possibilities of instabilities which could be preludes to the collapse of this chain. And this last work was also done in collaboration with Tanya Liverpool. And basically, whereas for the first part of this talk, which is not very relevant to physical situations, I can make precise statements, and I'm confident as I go down further and get to things that are more relevant, there are more approximations and less confidence in the results. So let me start by the simple model where one can do some precise things. And the idea is to idealize a polymer to a walk, as I've indicated over here. And the thing that is discrete, it's not necessarily the location of these particles. In this picture, they look like they are sitting on a square lattice. They could actually be in continuum. What is discrete is the angle between two bonds. And here I've indicated 90-degree angle, but that's not necessary. As long as the simplest deformation that you can make for a bond is a finite angle, the results that I will say will continue to apply. So the important ingredient of the model is a finite bond angle. So the model consists of n charges, Q, placed on this chain. And the other approximation that makes this unrealistic is that they interact by unscreened Coulomb interaction. So I have a 1 over R interaction between any pair of these charges. So given that model, what can we say? Well, one thing that we know for sure is that the ground state is going to be a straight configuration. What's the energy of that ground state? You basically have to sum 1 over r for every pair of points. And the thing that is important to note is that this energy ends up not being extensive in length because you have to do two integrations of 1 over r. You basically get a factor of L log L. So the energy is slightly overextensive by a factor of log L, and that has some interesting consequences about this continuum limit that I mentioned. So I'll put the model over here and continue to talk about its consequences. So the ground state, as we said, is when everything is straight. So what's the simplest excitation that I can have? The simplest excitation is what I will call a kink, in which you basically deform a pair of bonds that are next to each other. So this is as close to being straight and having just a single excitation or kink in the system.
Is it obvious that a bend at the end is the lower energy excitation?
The same thing occurring at the end, yes.
No, I don't mean a kink, I mean an actual bend. So I bend, let's say, the last five.
Okay, if you do a finite number, it's fine. But if you bend anywhere in the center,
well,
or yes,
agree,
yeah.
I would guess that that could well be a lower energy.
Yes. Yes. In fact, here I allow this single bend, if you like, to occur all the way close to the end. So if you like, the bend of unit length, the smallest energy of your bend is included in this. Okay. And indeed, the energy cost of making this deformation gets lower, as Michael predicted, when you get closer to the end. But if it is somewhere near the center, the energy cost goes like log L. And the reason for that is that whenever you make any one of these deformations, you have shortened the end-to-end distance. And since very roughly the energy scales with the end-to-end distance as L log L, if you were to change L by a small amount, you gain a logarithmic amount of energy. In fact, there is dependence on exactly where you put this, and as you get closer to the two ends indicated by S here, the energy goes down. So the energy is the product of this part times that part divided by the full length. But roughly, most of the time, the energy grows like L, log L, and then it should remind you of a number of problems in statistical mechanics where there are log L energies for elementary excitations, like the vortices in the two-dimensional XY model or one-dimensional chain studied by Anderson and Yuval that have, let's say, Ising models with 1/r² interactions. The reason that's important, because the entropy of such an object also grows like log L, because there are L places that you can put it. So you may, in the back of your mind, think of something like a Costa-Lick-Stahles transition that should occur at a characteristic temperature. There is a big difference, however, in this case and vortices in the XY model or domain boundaries in the Ising chain with 1/r² interactions, and that is subsequent kinks that I can add to the system will also contribute to further shortening of the chains. So the energy keeps going up and up logarithmically. There is no screening, as you would have for plus and minus defects in the XY transition, etc. Don't I allow what? Oh, if I reverse the chain, then I gain a whole lot of Coulomb energy, because everything comes. So these are indeed the lowest energy configurations. Okay? So to the lowest order, I can construct an energy cost for these kinks, which depends, first of all, on their location. There is a factor like this. And then whether or not they are present. So I introduce a variable that is 0 if there is no kinks at some location, and 1 or minus 1 if the kink goes up or down. At this stage, actually, for this very simple Hamiltonian, it doesn't matter whether the kink goes up or down. And the energy is sum of independent kinks placed at different locations. And for such a simple system, actually, it is very simple to calculate the net number of these kinks or defects that you can have by just summing the probability of having a defect on each particular bond, which is given by standard Boltzmann weight from this energy. And then the total number of kinks, which is sum of them, has a dependence that is indicated over here. Basically, this dependence indicates that competition between energy and entropy. The entropy is n to the 1 here, this factor of 1, because there are n possible locations that I can put it. and the, sorry, that's the entropy, and the energy is this log of epsilon that I indicated over here, epsilon divided by t, with a log, which when I exponentiate it, gives me n to the minus epsilon over t, which I can, if you like, in terms of the Buron length, etc., write in this fashion. So basically, what you would conclude is that for low temperatures, the number of kinks should go to zero asymptotically, whereas for large temperature, larger than this characteristic temperature over here, you should have a liberation or proliferation of these kinks. And however, the thing is that the net number of kinks that you have is never extensive. It's not proportional to the length of the chain, hence you don't have a finite density. You have zero density asymptotically, except at infinite temperature, where n becomes proportional to big N. Okay, how good is this model in which the only thing that is put in is the energy of a single kink, and I completely ignore interactions between kinks? Well, it turns out that it works very well, and here's a comparison to a numerical simulation for a chain of length 128, and the reason that this is not quite a straight line and you don't see the asymptotic limit is because you have a finite number of links, but the theoretical calculation is also done for a finite number and seems to agree very well. So basically, this very simple approximation of ignoring the interactions between kinks is sufficient to tell me how many kinks I have at a particular temperature, even in a finite system where I have to worry about boundary effects, because in this calculation, the energy and the probabilities at the boundaries were calculated correctly. Okay, so basically at low temperatures, there are going to be very few of these kinks, and then suddenly at this characteristic temperature, they're going to be liberated. Is there some heat capacity signature to that? Well, there is a weak heat capacity signature. It's not a two-phase transition, so you don't see a diverging heat capacity or anything like that, but there is a characteristic peak that one is observing. The results above are from this from a correct numerical simulation. And yes, these are chains whose lengths I unfortunately eliminated, 8, 16, 32, 64, etc.
Okay?
It scales, but not extensively. It has some kind of strange log dependence, etc.
It has what?
It has a log dependence that he puts in always.
Yeah. So, in a true phase transition where everything is extensive, the heat capacity would be simply proportional to the number of degrees of freedom or the number of particles. Here, that's not the case. There are lots of inextensive things in this problem. So basically, you can say that everything that you see in this problem is a finite size effect, because the zeroth order things have all vanished. There is nothing extensive in this problem. Okay. Actually, even more important about than width is location. Does this peak always occur at a given temperature? And you can see it doesn't. In fact, it drifts towards higher temperature, and the location of the maximum seems to grow like the logarithm of the size. Okay. Okay. Now, I started talking about transverse fluctuations. So basically, the zero temperature, you have a flat chain. At finite temperature, you have these excitations, and so there will be some fluctuations, and there will be some characteristic width. So the question is, what is the characteristic width of these chains? And if you have n of these kinks, and the kinks are independently pointing up or down, you would say, just from random walk argument, that the characteristic width should grow like the square root of the number of kinks that you have in the problem. And since you know how the number of kinks scales with the total length of the polymer, you would say that the width for transverse fluctuations scales with length to some characteristic roughness exponent, which is just one half the exponent that governs the number of kinks as a function of length, and that exponent varies continuously with temperature. So basically, it is only at infinite temperature that you would see the result that the roughness should grow like the square root of the length, which is what we expected based on continuum picture. This sort of width going like the square root of the length sounds very much like a random walk, but it's not a random walk because it really includes the Coulomb interaction among all of the bonds, etc. It sort of accidentally turns out to be the same that an exponent that you would have for a random walk.
No, I have one difficulty here. At the lowest level, the kinks can go up or down without any effect.
Yes.
But once I have a finite density of kinks, if they go up, there will be a tendency to keep the thing straight.
Right.
Those kinks will have a lower energy. Is that in these calculations anywhere?
Not yet, but I'll show you when it becomes necessary to include them. Okay? So this model, which ignores this important interaction between kinks that Michael pointed out, would predict that the width goes with this exponent. So if you are at low temperature, the width should vanish. If you are at high temperature, it should grow. And this is, again, plot of the numerical result as a function of temperature. And all I will say at this stage is that it is roughly consistent that at low temperature, the width seems to go down until it saturates because of edge effects, while at high temperature, the square of the width goes up with n, but not linearly, sublinearly, which is the prediction here.
So you always keep the same initial direction?
Yes.
Where you expected that it's the linear way
for a finite length, they would indeed, because there would be rotational diffusion. But even when you have, if you sort of take an instantaneous picture, when they are rotated, you can still calculate their width. Indeed, what is plotted here is not with respect to a particular axis. It's the second moment of inertia, which, independent of how you rotate it, will give you the right result. Okay. But there is something quite not correct in this assumption that the kinks independently point up and down, which was anticipated and is reflected over here. If the kinks independently go up and down, and then the width goes like the square root of the number of kinks, we would expect the width to monotonically go up with temperature, because as you go to higher and higher temperatures, you create more of these kinks. And so the prediction would be that the width goes up monotonically with temperature. Yet, when we do the simulations, we find that this second moment of inertia, which is a measure of the width, as a function of inverse temperature, it goes up with increasing temperature, but it peaks, and then actually it comes down again. Okay? So there is something to worry about, and indeed we checked by other means. Because the model at infinite temperature where there is no Coulomb interaction is trivial, you can certainly solve it exactly at that point, and then you can do a 1 over t expansion around that point and indeed confirm that you start with a random walk at infinite temperature, and then the width starts going up as you lower the temperature because the Coulomb interactions want to repel the kinks from each other or point them in different in parallel direction, and that's indicated over here, which is, let's sort of look at two kinks, in this case parallel, in this case anti-parallel. When they are parallel, you can see that the end points are slightly further away at a second order than the case where they are anti-parallel. So you would say that this is energetically favored compared to this. And indeed, what we did was we numerically calculated, unfortunately plotted here in yellow, the interaction energy between two kinks as a function of their separation. And we see that at each separation, it is favorable to have parallel kinks as opposed to anti-parallel kinks. And so there is actually a repulsion between kinks of either sign, and there is a preference to have parallel kinks compared to anti-parallel kinks. So if we use this piece of information to improve the energetics that I had written down before, we can work with a slightly better Hamiltonian compared to the one that had independent kinks, in which we basically also account for this factor by including an interaction that depends on whether the kinks are parallel or anti-parallel to each other. And there is an overall repulsion between kinks independent of their sign, and there is a tendency for kinks to be parallel. And then what you can do is, within this Hamiltonian, you can see that there is a tendency for kinks, now represented by these spin variables, plus or minus one, to be parallel to each other. One can calculate that tendency from that Hamiltonian in a 1 over T expansion. It's given by actually a long-range formula, because the interactions, the basic interactions, are long-range. If the kinks have a tendency to be parallel to each other, that will increase the width of the kink, because the width is basically the sum of these random variables, and there is a part that contributes to the sum from the correlation between these random variables, which we calculated up here. And if you put it into the formula, what you find is that the width is, width squared is not only the number, but has a correction because of the tendency for the kinks to be parallel to each other. And it is this term that wins at very high temperatures and increases your width, whereas the overall density actually reduces with temperature, so at sufficiently low temperature, the width goes back down again. And in fact, this form, just with this first order correction, fits very well the curves that I had shown you before. It turns out that, again, all of these are finite size effects. That is, if I take the n goes to infinity limit, width goes like the square root of n is asymptotically correct, and therefore the location that you see for this peak is again dependent on the number of kinks that you have, a number of the length of the polymer, and grows like log n. Okay, is any of this relevant to real polyelectrolytes? Well, as I said, for real polyelectrolytes, you can imagine that you will have two different types of deformations. One set of deformations is when you take the bond angles and just bend them slightly with respect to each other. So these are continuous deformations. And the others are more discrete deformations, where you go between isomeric situations, or you include more complicated deformations, such as knots, etc., in the problem. Any one of these second set of deformations lead to a shortening of the chain, and hence they will be subject to this logarithmic type of energy penalty, and the discussions that we had would apply, whereas the continuum deformations would not be subject to that. For the, you can calculate the contribution of each one of these to the width separately. For the case of the discrete deformations, we saw that there is a dependence that goes like a power that depends on temperature, or alternatively on the ratio of the Durham length and some elementary length. Whereas for the continuous case, if you again follow the standard Odaic type of calculations for bending rigidity, etc., you would conclude that the width goes like the square root of the length with a prefactor that's the Durham length. So presumably both of these are present and should be added to each other. And in particular, something that people are interested is what is the extent of the angular fluctuations that are induced by this characteristic width. Well, if the width is W over a length L, the fluctuations in angle are of the order of that ratio. And that, in the standard theories of OSF, the persistence length of the polymer is calculated as follows. You would say that basically over a debye length, you can regard the chain as unscrewed, and so you would use those formulas, and you would get a characteristic angle theta at the scale of the debye length, which is very small, and then you ask how many of those debye lengths do you have to put together so that the angular correlations or fluctuations become of the order of one, And so that's just the square root of the number of those elementary lengths that you have to put together. And from here, you can calculate what the persistence length should be and how it should depend on the Debye length. And if you include within the Debye length only these discrete fluctuations, you would conclude that the persistence length should have a dependence on the Debye length that goes through a fractional power that depends on temperature, whereas the standard continuous models would predict a more familiar formula of the persistence length being proportional to the square of the Debye length. Now, unfortunately, again, since this exponent is always less than 2, asymptotically, the continuous fluctuations should dominate. I don't know whether there is some regime where one can play around and make this term dominant.
Excuse me, before you didn't have any Debye length, you were speaking about this logarithmic penalty.
Yes.
And this is when the Debye length is larger than the size of the chain, or?
Yes, okay. That's right. Now, I make this approximation, which people usually make in calculation of persistence length, that fluctuations at the scale less than the Debye length are as if the system is on screen. I actually don't believe that to be very correct, but I'm just following what other people do in this. So suppose one were to include counter ions properly, what should one do? So basically, let's imagine that we have two macro ions. They could be polymers, there could be charged surfaces or whatever, and they are in a solution of neutralizing counter ions. How should one calculate the proper interaction between them independent of the nature of once you integrate out the counter ions? Basically, what you want to do is to calculate a restricted partition function. So you fix the positions and shapes of the macro ions, indicated by big R's, and you integrate over all possible locations of the counter ions, indicated by small r's, of e to the minus h, the interaction, which is mainly here the Coulomb interaction. So the Coulomb interaction is just the 1 over r. There is no screening because everything is included here. I mean, the counter ions are the things that are supposed to give you the screening ultimately. So you have the charge density at some location, the charge density at some other location with 1 over r interaction. And the charge density, of course, has two contributions, one coming from the macro ions with some kind of surface charge density or whatever, and one coming from the counter ions, which are assumed to have valence Z. Okay? So I think Michael Fisher and possibly others mentioned the dreaded Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation, so let me indicate what it is. Basically, what you can do is you can rewrite e to the minus the Coulomb interaction over kT in the form of a functional integral over some field, phi, which you can regard as the fluctuating electric potential, really electrostatic potential, with the charges or the charge density appearing as a source. Now, the advantage of this formulation is that one can immediately integrate over the counter ions, and so the integration over the counter ions can be done so that you are left with a restricted partition function for the macro ions, depending on their shape, which is an integral over this potential, where your initial theory becomes more complicated by a term that is something like e to the I z phi. So this is a kind of Sine-Gordon field theory in which the charges of the macro ions appear as sources. Now, the relationship between this and the standard Poisson-Boltzmann equation is the following, that if you regard this field theory, one of the first things that you want to do is to find which configuration of the field maximizes this weight, and that saddle point is precisely the Poisson-Boltzmann equation. So basically, the Poisson-Boltzmann equation is obtained at the saddle point of this field theory, and Of course, it's a very difficult equation to solve, but once you have that in principle, you can go beyond the Poisson-Boltzmann by including quadratic fluctuations around the saddle point. Okay. So basically what you do is you say that I have to integrate here over all configuration of the field. I know the most likely configuration is the solution to the Poisson-Boltzmann, and I slightly perturb around that solution to see what happens. And then the restricted partition function becomes what you get from the Poisson-Boltzmann, the solution to the Poisson-Boltzmann. And at the level of expanding things to quadratic order, you have to do a quadratic integral, a Gaussian integral, which is basically the second derivative of this object. And Gaussian integrals we can in principle do because they are related to the determinant of this kernel here, and so once I translate that to a free energy, I find that the free energy that I would have for the macro ions in the presence of the counter ions has two parts. The first part is the familiar one, which will be the solution to the Poisson-Boltzmann, which is of course very difficult, but let's suppose that we have done that somehow. And then there is a correction to that for which I need to calculate the determinant of a complicated kernel that has within it the solution to the full Poisson-Boltzmann equation appearing in this density of the counter ions. So what I need is to solve the Poisson-Boltzmann equation here. This term here is the density of the counter ions. So I need to get a profile for the density of the counter ions, insert it here, and then calculate this log determinant. Now that typically is hard, so part of the time I will also be using an approximation as follows. I will say that in cases where you have a lot of condensation, there is a lot of counter ions that have collapsed on top of the macro ions, maybe it's not such a bad approximation within this term, not within this term, to replace the charge density of the counter ions with the charge density of the macro ions that they are trying to shield. So rather than having this term that exists all over the space, I basically collapse it on top of the macro ions, and that slightly simplifies the calculations, and I'll call that a Gould-Chapman approximation.
Collapse all of the charge?
Yes. Yes.
What would justify doing that? There's only part of the charge.
That's condensed. That's what you would say. Actually, within here, within the exact solution here, you have part of it. It turns out, again, the calculation, this is really justified by the doability of the calculation, let's say. And then let's compare how good it is to one situation where we can do things exactly. Actually, no, I will get a small correction to the Poisson-Boltzmann.
You're going to get a correction to the current of the attraction.
No, I will get a correction which is an attraction. I don't claim that it is always strong enough, and here is an example where we can see how strong it is. Yes. Well, the first question is your assumption that there is a significant correction. Okay? So if there is a significant correction, which is what happens, let's say, when you are doing Ginzburg criterion, then you would deduce that, okay, you would need to go and include all of the higher order terms. Okay? So I don't want to go to the regime where there is really a significant correction and one needs to go to higher order.
I will allow the coefficient in front of NM.
This coefficient?
No, allow to put some effective coefficient that the number of counter ions is not equal to the bulk.
Okay. For the purposes of the calculation of the log determinant, it is very easy for me to calculate log determinant if I don't have to deal with a function that is varies in most of the space. So once I have replaced that with putting part of it on the surface, that is a simpler calculation, but how much of it I put on the surface, I'm free. It doesn't make things very different. Okay? So the one case where one can do things exactly and see how good this approximation is, etc., is when you have two charge plates and the counter ions in between. The solution of the saddle point, the Poisson-Boltzmann equation, gives you that there is a repulsion between the two plates whose magnitude is given over here. It's kT, A over H falls off like valence squared, etc. And basically, you have a 1 over H repulsion as a function of the separation between the two plates. And of course, the whole reason that we go and do these corrections is to try to get a compensating attraction. And what we find is that there is an attraction when you do the integration over these fluctuations. In this approximation that I mentioned over here, where I basically collapse the density onto the plates, what we find is that there is an attraction which is very similar to the standard Casimir interaction. You have a field that is allowed to fluctuate except at the boundaries, and that gives you an interaction energy that goes like kT, area over H squared, and some prefactor that one can calculate is the standard Casimir. And what you were asking me about, rather than putting a fraction of the charge there, etc., really only appears at higher order. The good thing about this Casimir interaction is that it is totally independent of, once you decide to collapse things onto the boundaries, how much you want to collapse onto the boundaries. That occurs in the corrections only. So this part of it is actually very robust. Okay? Now, one can also do the full for the one-dimensional case. There is no need to make this approximation. This is, I think, the only case I know where you can calculate the log depth for the full density. And this is the result that you would get out of the complete calculation without making this approximation. So that's the answer to your question of how good is it. Okay, so you can see that you get basically that first term, but you also get additional terms. In fact, the correct result seems to give you more attraction. This approximation seems to, if anything, underestimate the amount of attraction. So we, at least for this case, we have an idea of how good or how bad this approximation is.
Maybe I'm misreading what you put in there, Mara.
You're worried about it.
The log term I would have put first, so that seems to dominate over the constant term.
Yes.
So on the dot dot, how do I know that it's the log squared of H?
There isn't. Yeah. Indeed, if I was honest, as you say, I would have put this first and then that, and then you wouldn't have asked me this question. But I wanted to make the comparison up here. Okay. Okay. So, quite a few people have, of course, put forward the idea of these fluctuation-induced interactions, which is typically justified as follows, that you have the counter ions condensing on the macro ions, and then you have fluctuations in the density of the counter ions inducing dipole-dipole and van der Waals types of attractions. And I just want to indicate the similarity between this idea and this kind of formulation. Basically, as most recently put forward by Hao and Liu and explained in the talk by Andrea, you can assume that there is a Coulomb interaction between the macro ions, where rather than putting the basic charge density that you have in the counter on the macro ions, you allow it to change because of the screening by the counter ions. And so then what you do is you integrate over the charge density minus some average value with some fluctuations. Now, if you were to do a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation on this, which is what Andrea and company also do, basically it is equivalent to replacing this full theory, and in particular this Sine-Gordon part, with fluctuations that only occur on the macro ions. So basically these things are in the same spirit. You sort of allow the fluctuations only to occur on the macro ions. So really these two formulations are more or less the same. Yes?
In our reference C, it wasn't, we did not expect through these kind of fluctuations, but instead of the correlation which developed along the tangent between the two. So
right.
That's actually quite distinctly that two defects
yes.
mean field to the absence of certain fluctuations
right. right.
and the absence of short tangent correlation, which is when the whole possible constriction comes out.
Okay.
So when short tangent correlations play a key role, and when things like finite size behind, like the discussion of light laser yesterday,
okay.
Both effects are in principle present.
Okay. Thank you for that correction. Okay, so I want to go back to the deformations of the polyelectrolyte, which is what I started with, and I looked at the discrete deformations. Now I'm only going to include the continuous deformations, having said that one should be careful about discrete deformations and irrelevance of the continuum limit. Possibly I'm going to forget that and do the continuum deformations. And so what I would like to do is to figure out once there is counter-ions and counter-ion condensation, possibly even salt, what is the energy cost of bending a rod? So what I want to do is to calculate a restricted partition function depending on the shape of the rod. One part of it is the standard bending energy with some persistence length LP. The other part is the Coulomb energy, for which I use the model proposed by Liu et al. With this kind of thing in the back of my mind, in that I integrate over a Coulomb interaction where I allow the charge density along the rod to vary with some variance with respect to some average value. Now, with that model, what you can do is you can calculate the energy cost of small deformations, and the small deformations around the rod are indicated by R of S. Once you Fourier transform that, you can calculate the energy cost of deformation of a particular mode with wave number k, and that is given by a term that is epsilon of k. So dependence of the bending of the rod at wave number k on on k has a number of terms, the most familiar of which is just the standard bending rigidity with the persistence length LP. Then there's the Coulomb interaction, which is, say, the idea that Odaik had, that if you try to bend this, you bring the charges close to each other, and there is a corresponding Coulomb interaction. The Coulomb interaction, because it's long-range, gives you a contribution to the bending rigidity, which is k squared log k. It's not a bending rigidity, it's because it's not k to the fourth, but it's a contribution that opposes bending. And this term is modified by the presence of these fluctuations. It is reduced. And in addition to this, from these fluctuation-induced terms, you get an attraction, a term which is opposite sign, and goes like k cubed. So this is the energy cost of bending of wave number k. And so what you want to do is to see that it is always positive so that the modes are stable. Should one of these epsilon k's become negative, then that particular mode would be inherently unstable and something should occur. And basically what we did was we constructed a phase diagram. Whenever we saw one of these modes became negative, and the phase diagram is indicated here, as a function of two parameters. One of them is the ratio of LP over A. A is the separation of the charges along the chain. And the other is L over A. We are explicitly looking at finite polymers. Basically, the question you want to ask is the following. I mean, we know that at very high temperatures, where there is no screening or very little screening, this object should be extended. We know that at very low temperatures, the best configuration is for everything to collapse so that all of the plus and minus charges are together. Maybe you will even get some kind of a Wigner type of crystal like Boris Shklovsky mentioned. And so you can ask, what is the, how does this transition from the high temperature to the low temperature occur? And one question is it a long wavelength instability in which the whole chain sort of initially bends at the longest length and then continues to do so? Or is it something that occurs at short length scales where it sort of crunches up locally? And of course, the natural answer is that it should be a short distance effect, because what we see from all of these solutions is that the longest range interactions, once you include Poisson, Boltzmann, etc., is still a Coulomb repulsion. And if the attractions have any chance, because they are shorter range fluctuations, they should occur at shorter length scales. And just dimensionally, the length scale where this should occur should be the Burom length, LB. Just that's the only length.
Infinite dilution?
Yes. Well, that's, what do you mean by infinite dilution? This is a single chain.
I don't think it was a Burom length, because in the low temperature case, it's an actual length scale, which is not temperature dependent. And the Burom length is singular to zero. It
yes.
It's less constant of bigger degrees.
Well, that's... I agree. That's the way that you would that's the way that you would reason if you started from the low temperature theory. If you start from the high temperature theory, then the length scale that occurs for the attractions is the Burom length.
But if you first order transition to a low temperature state, then it's there where you get.
If there is a first order transition, which, as far as I know, unless you have a good theory.
The point of the transition test,
yes.
There is no difference between time, because then your length will equal to like a constant at this point.
Okay. But in any case, in any case, maybe in retrospect, what I show here is an answer to that, which is basically, again, as I said, we are dealing with short chains. And so what we find is that if the chain is short enough, the mode that becomes unstable is the one that corresponds to pi over L, the longest wavelength. And so that sort of we indicate as going from an extended to something that is collapsed. If the chain becomes long enough, then the modes that are unstable are shorter wavelengths. And so maybe there is possibility of some necklace-like structure in between. And of course, whenever the instability sets in, beyond that, the theory is no longer reliable. So you shouldn't believe this red line, which is a continuation of that green line. So, but presumably, if this occurs, there should be another crossover or transition where you go from this to this. And again, the result is very dependent on Z, and this is for Z of 4. Now, the thing that I said is that, again, independent of whether one should worry about lattice effects, etc., for self-consistency of my approach, I have used the continuum formulation. Within my approach, I say that the characteristic length where this should occur is when L is of the order of LB. That seems to come out dimensionally, etc. And if that is the case, why should I believe at all the continuum formulation that I'm using? Because there I should really be worried about things that are occurring at microscopic scales, maybe Wigner crystals, etc. And the thing that seems to work is, at least for this phase diagram, there are all of these thousands, 2,000s, 3,000s, etc. And it seems that the p-factors somehow push this to regimes that are orders of thousands of lattice spacing. Part of the thing that pushes it off is actually a factor of z to the fourth, so this is for a very favorable z for me, but the other p factors seem to also work. So I would really say that, again, I believe the continuum formulation only if I end up with characteristic length scales where things happen that are not of the order of lattice spacings or microscopic size, and 1,000 is really good enough for me. Now, if you go to the case where there is a finite amount of salt and finite persistence length, sorry, a finite Debye length, where did I? So the calculation that I presented before was for kappa equals to zero. If I now redo the calculation with a finite kappa, then because there are no longer long-range interactions, the energy as a function of k will be analytical. The coefficient of k to the fourth I can read off as an effective rigidity, which is increased from the bare value by a part that is electrostatic and goes like the Bylent squared, which is the prediction of Odyk. And then the fluctuation part will give a negative contribution over here. And you would say that there will be an instability in the system if the net effect becomes negative. And again, if I believe that that formula is correct and I don't have to correct for higher order terms, etc., then I will find that there is a transition between extended and unstable, possibly collapsed state that occurs on these boundaries. And you can see that the shape of the boundary is very sensitive to the valence Z. And again, I would believe the result possibly for 2 or 3 because I'm dealing with large numbers, large lengths. But when I get to Z equals to 1, I really don't trust the continuum formulation anymore. Don't know what's happening.
What is the horizontal axis?
The horizontal axis is the lambda divided over A. The vertical axis is LP over A. So actually, all of these collapse transitions occur provided that the bare persistence length is below some characteristic value. If the bare persistence length is sufficient, no matter what you do, you will never get a collapse. And this characteristic value in our picture actually scales like Z to the fourth, part of the reason that these things are pushed up and sort of saves you. Okay? That's all I wanted to say. Thank you very much. The known results are from numerical simulations. What was the second
calculation?
Yes, integral equations. Yes, yeah. We haven't compared that, but that's certainly something to do. Yes.
At which distance is your fluctuation? That was about this charge rods and. Which distance is that fluctuation correction is so comparable to the basic repulsion?
Okay, on dimensional grounds, basically what you find is that the power law for the fluctuation-induced corrections is always down by 1.
Yes.
And the coefficient dimensionally is of the order of Beuron length. But then that LB has in front of it various factors of Z and some numerical three factors, etc., that push it up. So dimensionally, I would say that its characteristic length scale should be the Beuron length, but somehow it seems to be pushed up by numbers that should be order of unity by a factor of 2 orders of magnitude or something.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what the nature is of collapse state? You think of two possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
One is a collapse state is similar to an ordinary collapse column, like a random.
Yes.
And the other one is a torus, where you have, like you see in DNA,
yes.
They have both symmetry, so to
speak. Yes.
We wouldn't imagine that there are multiple forms of collapsed state. Have you...
I have a feeling that if you tell me that if I have a long wavelength instability and it goes to a torus, then I can start expanding for fluctuations around the torus, and then I will find another wavelength that becomes unstable. So...
With DNA, you seem to see the torus, and for high spectral for electrolyte, I think it's more than a block, so it seems well possible.
Well, those toruses, I mean, maybe you're referring to the toruses you saw, you're referring to a different one, but the ones we saw were induced by particular mechanisms, which depended strongly on the stoichiometry.
But in general, if you have something pure which has a high shift length and you want to put it through a shoulder, the natural thing is to wind it around the torus.
Well, again, you have to be careful because, as he alluded right at the beginning, it's always possible to actually bend these things rather sharply. It
right.
costs you an energy, but relative to bending, it may not be so long.
For short resistance, intrinsic resistance length, you certainly will get a spherical symmetric block. But if you increase the resistance length, the ground state may well not be a block, but instead a torus.
Then I think it's a much more detailed question, and it's going to depend a lot on the binding. If we here remember the multivalent binding, then I can imagine, and we saw some of the pictures where it's folded up into a rod, where you pay the bending energy at the center,
right.
you gain a linear binding energy and keep it straight.
That's a third possibility, a zigzag along a rod. So there are a variety of possibilities.
Yes.
You were telling us about the epsilon of k that governs the fluctuations, and there was a strange term that we didn't see before that has take u.
Yes.
That was the sexy term.
Yes.
Can you give us a feeling for a way to
take you? I kind of alluded to this, that the fluctuation induced terms are one power of separation lower. So if you have 1 over r for the standard Coulomb, then the corrections go like 1 over r squared. So when you go to Fourier space, you get one higher power of k. So the standard Coulomb interaction, as you, for example, looked at in the paper with V gives you a k squared log k, the next higher one would definitely have to be k cubed then. So that's, and if you want to sort of justify it, you would say that k squared is the Fourier transform of 1 over r integrated, then k cubed would be the Fourier transform of 1 over r squared appropriately integrated.
A little louder, I say.
In principle, there are two different things, which is their bendability and the character of fluid volume constraint. And what actually pushes the system towards torus-like manipulation is not so much rigidity itself, but the tendency to go parallel to each other, to lift the series align, locally managed organization, which is not necessarily.
But if you look at polyethylene, which is not normally thought of as a very rigid polymer, then it folds up in nice straight parallel things with just the schematic order parameter first and then kinetically bends. So I agree with you. They're very distinct things.
That's a good example. Another good example is you get, on average, you get high air rigidity, but it is not warm-like. It's not diffusing distributed towards the length. There are rocks, then you don't get torus at all.
The issue of volume often is frustrated for us, because they keep on winding torus, like Bill Delbert showed. It's not a couple of
torus
going, and you have to add
topological defense.
Okay, so let's have a private discussion during the break. Let's thank you again.
Okay.